Morning, friends. This is Martin Zender here coming to you from North Carolina, thus the Carolina Cam, at the home of Waylon and Regina Dabbs in a little town called China Grove, just like the Doobie Brothers. I had another little perfecting thought on the crucifixion of how we're crucified with Christ. It's the fact that when you watch a reenactment of the crucifixion, you're transfixed, just like Christ was on the cross. A crucified person can't move. And so when we look at the cross, in this sense, we're crucified with Christ. Now, we're crucified with Christ in many different senses, many different ways. The ultimate way, of course, is humanity as a whole was considered to have died. But I'm seeing the new twist here, a new fine detail, is that we can't move either. Just like Christ on the cross was pinned, we're pinned. Can't move as we look on. This doesn't mean that you don't eventually get up and work as to the Lord to promote the truth. It just means that even while you're being animated by God for good works, you never lose the thought, which is the truth, that you're immobilized in the sense that there's nothing you can do to make yourself worthy of or add to the cross. Now, I've been pleasantly surprised by the comments I've received about me talking about my testimony. You have welcomed it, and you're happy about it, and you're interested in it. So I was happy to hear that. Like I said, I was ready to delete all of that. But now that I know that you're good with it, I'll continue today. This will be the last day that I give you some highlights of what God's done in my life. And I don't do this simply to recount the highlights of my life, but I'm confident that something I say in the next 15 or 20 minutes is going to encourage you in your walk, in your work with Christ, for Christ, because of Christ. I told you yesterday of how I spun my Bible around sometime in the 80s and God honored it. And I said I did it one more time. Yes, I did do it one more time. Many of you have heard this, but I'll say it somehow differently today. And for those of you who have heard it, I appreciate you bearing with me for the sake of those who haven't heard this, because I think it's helpful. I just quit my full-time job with the Postal Service, which was one of the scariest things I ever did, to work this job full-time, because I had a wife and three kids. And my wife, Marcia, and me, we went to a hotel. It was our anniversary a week after I started this work full-time. And we were watching television at this hotel in Canton, Ohio. I think it was the Comfort Inn off Eberhard Road, Eberhard and Whipple. It was up on a hill, and the thing, get this, the thing was shaped like Noah's Ark. It's interesting in light of what I'm going to tell you. So we were flipping through the channels, just watching, you know, channel surfing, looking at all the insanity, and we were both under a really strong spiritual conviction because we were doing something extremely bold, some called crazy. I was warned not to quit my job by many people. I told it was going to be a disaster because I didn't have much savings, because I didn't have any subscribers yet. Again, it was a Field of Dreams scenario where I was tearing down my cash crop and building something for the purpose of something I could not yet see. A great parallel is Abraham, who was told to leave his father's house, leave his country, and go to a place that he was not yet versed in where that place would be. And that's the beauty of faith, and God gives many, God sets us up so that we have to walk by faith. So we're in this hotel room channel surfing, and it just seemed to us both that the world was in chaos. People were basically screaming. Everybody, even whether it was a sitcom or a commercial, it seemed to me that people were living lives of quiet desperation, and they were all in inner turmoil, not knowing where they came from or where they were going. And the sense became very strong to me, and I shared this with Marcia, that these were the days as in the days of Noah, and that the flood was coming, and that these people were desperately seeking answers but not finding them. And it was my passion to give answers to people, to take the truth to them. And I would do that, and I have done it for the last 25 years. But what does Paul say? Paul says, after a first and a second admonition, you give up on people. This is Paul's advice. People ask me, what do I do when I give the truth to friends or relatives? I say, you give it two shots. You try twice. You go at them once. You go at them a second time. After that, Paul says, they have put themselves out. After that, they have decided that they want to be out. And that's a key word here, out. Back to the Noah analogy. Marcia and I felt this strong conviction that God was separating us, and He was calling us to something that was eventually going to have to leave the rest of the world behind. The parallel, of course, is Noah and his family going onto that ark, and the rain starts, and there must have been thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, I picture this anyway, banging on the ark, clawing on the ark, let us in. But there comes a time where, relatively speaking, and for the eon, it's too late. And God supernaturally closes the door of the ark, and you have to come to the point where you realize God is separating us. He's giving us a safe place, and the rest of the world is dying, and they're doomed to undergo the tribulation, and possibly to be judged at the great white throne later and suffer the second death. The second death isn't actually suffering. It's a figure of speech. They will not gain aeonian life. Others will. But the point here is, in the immediate future, there will be many, many people, because it's as in the days of Noah, who will miss out. Jesus said that concerning the Jews of his era, that many would not get aeonian life. Many of the Jews would not walk into the kingdom that they long dreamed of, that their forefathers had prophesied concerning, that Abraham taught them. That door was entered into by faith, and Israel did not have the faith. God didn't give them the faith. So they were going away. And we had the sense that the rest of the world was going away, and that we were being sealed into an ark of safety. And there had to come to the time where we just had to shrug and say, look, we'll be back for you. You know, it's like Noah's closing the door and says, like, hey, God will be back for you. Gets a big megaphone. God will be back for you. In the meantime, you're all going to drown, but hey, it's not the end. And it's not. What happened to all those people who died? We'll see them all again at the great white throne. They're not Israelites, because Noah's day was pre-Israel. Israel started with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They didn't believe in Jesus. That's impossible. So where do they fit? Those antediluvians, well, they fit at the great white throne. That's where they fit. Many of them, some will go onto the new earth. Probably many will be in the second death, because according to the testimony, people sinned as a vocation back in those days. So we felt like we were being sealed. Out came my Bible, and I spun it around again. I said, Lord, give me a word here. But at least I wasn't asking for like an audible word. At least I wasn't asking for God to speak to me, or for me to have a dream. I was at least using His actual revelation to us. Spun the thing around. This is the last time I've ever done this, but God honored it again. Spinning around, this time it was just the New Testament. I was using the concordant literal New Testament. Spun it around, put my finger, closed my eyes, finger randomly poked once again, because this felt profound. And the verse was unbelievable. It was from Acts 13, when the Spirit says, separate unto me Paul and Barnabas for the work which I will have them do. Actually, his name was Saul still back then. This was Acts chapter 13. Separate unto me Saul and Barnabas for the work which I have for them. Separate to me, separate. You see, that's what you're enduring now, a separation. And that's what I was enduring back then, a profound separation. And you're enduring it now because you've admonished, tried to teach your friends and family members once. You've done it twice. Maybe some of you have done it three or four times. But at that point, you're banging your head against a brick wall. And it's very frustrating. And so it was the perfect verse for the perfect time, because there was a separation. That's difficult because you know that everybody outside that ark's going to die. But you have to trust that we're coming back for you. And I say this many times, it bears repeating, is that God saves the elect for a purpose. He doesn't just save the elect in order to damn the rest. He saves the elect in order to save the rest. He sends the elect back to get those who were not elect. The elect become a spearhead group that bring the others in. Israel's a perfect example. God perfects Israel, ignores the other nation. Israel becomes a spearhead nation, goes into the kingdom, and then God uses Israel in accord with the prophecy given to Abraham, in you and your seed, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. That happens during the millennium. Well, we are a spearhead group. We are being perfected now while the rest of the world goes to smash, and we are going to be used to reach the rest of them. Not in this life, no, not in this life, but in the next life, in the eons to come. Paul says that in the eons to come, he will show the transcendent riches of his grace in his kindness to us in Christ Jesus. I had to relocate here because my phone overheated and stopped. Fortunately, everything I shot before that was saved. I just had to relocate here to the shade next to a barn. So let me tell you a little bit about the newsletters that I've produced, and this, I think, will be a great help to you. I sort of understood things when I started to write in 1986, but fortunately I started a newsletter. I only had 11 subscribers. Most of them were family, and I produced that newsletter in accord with a newsletter that I had seen for years called Echoes of Truth. It's by Ray Prinzing. Now, I really owe a lot to this man. He was a kingdom preacher, though, but he had the salvation of all figured out. And I would listen, driving back and forth on Bountainville Road between Greenwich and Willard to my job at the post office, I'd pop his tapes in. I'd listen to him coming and going. He had hundreds of tapes, and I just loved that stuff. I couldn't get enough of it. You know how it is when you first start coming into this truth. And Ray had a newsletter. It was a 6-page typewritten thing, and I wanted to go thou and do likewise. I thought, if this guy can do it, why can't I do it? So I started a thing called Food for Thought. But the thing is, I tried to model it after Ray Prinzing. I wanted to sound like him. I wanted my newsletter to look like his. He had one different colored page on the front, five typewritten pages after that. Like I say, and it was, I modeled myself after him. I was a clone. For a couple years, 1986, 1987, I was a Ray Prinzing clone. I don't know how many issues of Food for Thought I produced, maybe 12, 13, 15. I typed it with my handy bottle of white out there, and I took it to the printers and reproduced it, sent it to all 11 of my subscribers. So then something huge happened, a huge breakthrough. This is really instructive, I think. This applies to life. Shortly after I quit my post office job, started doing this, I knew I was going to write, but I didn't quite know how. I was maybe still 2 weeks away from quitting. I was walking through the woods near my house on a trail. And this is the closest thing I've ever gotten to, like, the path parting. Angels singing, beam of light coming out of heaven, shining on this vista. I had a thought that if it could be manifested, it probably would have radiated beams of light. It was the most liberating, exciting, freeing thought I ever had. And this is what it was. What if I wrote a newsletter and I made it a reflection of who I was. What if it was legal? And this didn't seem legal at the time. It was everything I've known that went before. What if it's legal to throw my personality into it, to not have to discard my personality when I sit down to write? Because everything I'd ever read, the writers would refer to themselves in the third person. The writer believes, the author of this article says, and it was like there was this humility, but I didn't see it as a genuine humility. I thought, hey, you're writing this article, why don't you just say I? Because people were afraid to say I, because there was this holy sheen that had to be on a person's writing, who was writing about God. Now, it's weird, because if people wrote a letter to their friends, or they wrote in a journal, people would write honestly, people would write forthrightly, people would write with enthusiasm and with color and with excitement. But as soon as you sit down to write about God, then you have to have this sheen of authority, this sheen of spirituality, of what you might be tempted to call spirituality, but it is not necessarily spirituality. And this is going to sound humorous to you, and I'm really embarrassed to admit it, but Ray Prenzing liked to talk about the Melchizedek priesthood. And to me, that sounded like the deepest thing you could ever get into as a teacher. The Melchizedek priesthood. He's teaching on the Melchizedek priesthood. He must be on level 7, man. This guy teaching on the Melchizedek priesthood, he's on another plane. This guy's barely mortal, man. I mean, he's up there with the angels. He's typing on a cloud. So I made sure once in a while that I'd put a reference in to the Melchizedek priesthood. Of course, I did find out what it was. I've perfected my understanding of the Melchizedek priesthood. It's another teaching. That's all it is. It's another teaching. But this stuff on this day in the woods, when the birds alighted on my shoulder and the butterflies flitted in a halo around my head, I said, to hell with the Melchizedek priesthood, in the sense that I needed to sound like an authority, or I needed to sound spiritual. And it was like, can I really write as I would write to a friend? Could I really produce a newsletter that was still deeply spiritual, but yet was communicated with the full color spectrum of my personality? And I believe I became short of breath, just entertaining the possibility. And then I wondered, if I do that, that means it might be funny. That means my newsletter might be funny. That seemed illegal. I'm serious. This is the way I thought, because of everything I'd read before, whether it was from Andrew Jukes or Ray Prenzing or Thomas Allen or George Houghton. All these writers, A.E. Nock, Guy Marx, none of these people were funny. Nock once in a while would wink at the reader. It's like, okay, there's a little bit of humor accidentally got through the blockade. And it's like, what if I just cut it loose? What if I cut it freaking loose? And then a really crazy thing hit me. This seemed even more illegal. And it was this. What if I put illustrations in it? What if I, yes, I'm serious. It sounds so logical now, so easy, but nothing I'd ever seen had illustrations in it, except like, here's a cutaway of the temple, or here's a cross-section of Noah's Ark, or here is the menorah of Israel. It's just all didactic, and none of it was fun. You had to want it bad. You had to want this truth bad. And people used big words like the Melchizedek priesthood. And I'm telling you, I just thought, what if I could do it differently? And it seemed pioneering to me at the time. It seemed like I was walking into a room that no one had been to yet. And I'm like going, hello, hello, hello. Is anybody here, here, here? And nobody was in the room. Oh, well, this is interesting. And part of me wanted it to be slick, but another part of me wanted it to be primitive. And I actually thought to stay with my typewriter, because something was telling me on that day that I was going to have to get a computer. I didn't have a computer. It was 1993, maybe 92 when this hit me, probably 93. And I hated technology, and I still do. And I thought, my God, I'm going to have to get a computer. What if I have to get a computer? I go, no, I won't get a computer. I'm just going to type it out, and I'm going to draw illustrations. I'm still going to use a typewriter because I don't want to get involved with that technology crap. But I'm going to draw illustrations, and I suck as an artist, believe me. If you saw my drawings, you'd be embarrassed, you'd avert your eye, because I draw like a five-year-old. Like, five-year-olds draw better than me. I thought, but that's perfect, I'm going to do that. Well, I eventually didn't do that. I eventually went to Radio Shack, and I bought a Tandy 386 SX, I think it was. It was a primitive computer, and I struggled, and I decided, I think it was in the woods. I'm going to have to end this video here. I got to tell you about my next three newsletters, because it's instructive, but I just got to end this today. But tomorrow, I guess I'll have to give you more. But I want Waylon to talk to you tomorrow, too, so I may have to put some of this on hold. But I ended up naming my newsletter The Idle Babbler Illustrated. It was based on a verse in New American Standard Bible, Acts 17:18. Paul is in Athens on Mars Hill, and Luke is in the audience. Luke is the author of Acts, and Luke is overhearing what the Greeks are saying as Paul is taking the podium, adjusting the microphone, clearing his throat. There were some Epicurean and Stoic philosophers in the crowd, and Luke was hobnobbing amongst them, and Luke heard one of them say, this is actually recorded in Scripture, thanks to Luke, "What would this idle babbler wish to say?" And they were speaking of Paul. And you have to keep in mind, on Mars Hill, it was like just one person after another taking the podium. They just wanted to hear something new. They wanted to hear something different. It was a parade of speakers who they wanted to titillate their ears. So their comments, here comes the next guy. Next, here comes Saul. And he was Paul at that time. And one of the philosophers said, Luke overheard it, "What would this idle babbler wish to say?" They called Paul an idle babbler. What could be farther from the truth? And yet I thought, how funny. I know my newsletter is going to be criticized, and I know I'm putting myself out in the public arena, so why don't I take a shot at myself before anybody else does? Why don't I start this thing at the bottom and never go anywhere? Start at working class, start at the bottom, and never rise from the bottom. Give truth from the bottom. So I'm going to call myself an idle babbler. What would this idle babbler wish to say? If it's good enough for Paul, it's good enough for me, right? Idle babbler. I'll call myself an idle babbler. So it was satire. It was self-depreciating. So I thought, I'm going to get a jump on my detractors. So I called it The Idle Babbler Illustrated. And the reception was beyond my expectations. It was a miracle. Just like the revelation that day was a miracle. And I'm amazed at what God has done since then. I'll pick up there sometime. I don't know if I'll pick up there tomorrow, because I'm going to talk to you with Waylon. Going to get Waylon on the camera. We're going to talk to you together about something. In the meantime, thanks for indulging my discussion of this. This all stemmed from a dream I had the other night when I woke up at 3 a.m. just thinking about what God has done. And I thought, it was somewhat comforting to relive these things. And I thought, well, if it was comforting for me, it might be comforting for you as well.